fixed it. Alright, so can we get the clarity? What are the documents specifically? Welcome everybody.
Major
are sending issues around the risk-based method solution, as we indicated that you will try and resolve this thing when you meet the person association and ask you about it. But with your application, I would pass on to FIC to facilitate us through the clauses and our responses to the issue. The clauses that are subject to policy review, we will not look at them exhaustively, we'll just familiarize ourselves with them. If we familiarize ourselves, it's easier when we actually do the final processing. You know, we can do word changes and so on, as we have to, but at least we're familiar with the clause. So now, what came out of your meeting with CUP? They wanted some measure. Chair, I will ask Raymond to update us, also Peter. But the sense I got from the teaching is that there is sort of an acknowledgement that the current exemptions might need to be tweaked just to better align them to the bill, which I thought would help us in terms of taking them forward. But let me ask Raymond to provide some details.
Thank you very much, good morning to you, Chair, and all the members. Chair, we did meet with the Casino Association, arising from some of the inputs they made in the meeting last week. And we in our view, and I think also from their perspective, that we had a very fruitful strategic approach concerning us on a number of key issues. The first thing, Chair, maybe let me go into clause number five. The understanding between us and the casino industry is that they have accepted our proposal that we will include in the bill provisions that relate to broad consultation when it comes to making guidance and regulations as well. This is a concern that was raised across the board by the various stakeholders, and the casino industry also has accepted that proposal from outside very well, and they are happy with that input. Some aspects also need to be discussed with the casino industry also is in terms of their ability to take steps in the implementation of the clauses relating to prominent persons and also those familiar members and associates. And they do acknowledge that there is a need for them to implement this, obviously subject to their own operations, to the extent that it is possible within their context as casinos. They undertook that they will try and take reasonable steps to be able to identify influential prominent persons. And this will also be linked to the necessary threshold which will be in place for their purpose. Now, this aspect also relates to the exemption that is currently in place in respect of the casino industry. The understanding here is that this exemption will still be available for them, but subject should be adjusted to be in line with the current bill and also around the risk-based approach that we are introducing through this bill. So they do accept that we cannot completely absolve them from implementing some of the most important provisions of the bill. However, we do agree that some aspects they will have to put them in place through the transitional process together with their supervisory bodies and agree in terms of the timeline to which they think they could be able and ready to fully implement the provisions of the bill. We also agree that they will.
Chairman, I am really baffling it. If we're talking about clause 5 of the amendment bill, it's one liner. I don't actually know where we are.
Just broadly at the policy issues and not keep it confined to any they have been under the impression that this bill could automatically take away the exemption that it has been able to operate under during the previous or the current existing act. So we did agree in principle that that is not exactly the case. What we need to do is to say the current exemption does remain, and as I indicated, also subject to the changes to align with the provisions of the fee, and also to be also done in accordance with the risk-based approach. So in other words, just like any other industry, we need to do the risk assessment to be able to have a better understanding of what are the risks within their space, and then to be able to then develop their risk management and their risk management program to take into account those risks that are unique to their industry, which we do acknowledge that the industry is not the same as other industries like the financial sector, and therefore their implementation of the risk, we need to take into account those differences. I don't think my colleague Peter also would want to expand as well. Thank you.
There's no written report of your meeting then, that we have. What the report is going to do is say, on this issue, they said this, we said this, this is what we're doing. But this is what we disagree on. On that issue, they said this, if they have a report on CASA itself, the meeting with CASA.
Secondly, Ashton Key is a matrix itself, Chair. We have responded to...
Oh, okay, I've done it. All right, fine. So basically what we need to do, it seems to me, there's not a way. If you get an overview, then we'll take each issue and say, okay, you and CASA agree to disagree. This is the view of the committee for now. Right, then the planning will come in and give our view as well, later. Whatever term you want to use, consistent with your remarks. I mean, you know, it's only how it is. You can't do it, you will just stop the meeting.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Good morning to everybody. I can just add two things to Raymond's summary. Two sort of key issues that we managed to find common ground with the casino industry. The first is on the understanding of how the Act applies to the casino business. In the current application of the Act, because casinos are currently subject to the FIC Act, the FIC Act requirements to identify a gambler or a customer of the casino applies where certain exchanges might be either to buy tokens to play on the machine or buy chips to play on the table or indeed chips for money to sell back to the casino, etc. So currently the FIC Act does not apply to every bet that a person places or every spin of the wheel or every deal of the cards. And we confirm that that will also be the way that the future, the Act will apply to the casino's future, and we will make sure that proper understanding of the terms of action in the context of casino business is maintained, as it has been up to now. So that the obligation of the casino applies where there's interaction between the casino and the customer around the exchange of money one way or the other, buying, selling of casino chips and tokens, etc. We also, as Raymond said, is currently an exemption that the Minister of Finance has granted to the casino industry, setting a threshold below which a casino doesn't have to identify its customers. So that exemption is the one that Raymond referred to that will have to be reviewed, and the value of that threshold might have to be adjusted when you down to a de minimis, a sort of threshold where you have to look at really small and low value transactions that are inconsequential in terms of risk management. I think that the second issue that we managed to clarify with the casino industry is to understand that where they form an ongoing relationship with the customer, in other words, they issue a loyalty card or something to that effect, they would apply the FIC Act on a risk-based approach to that risk, to that relationship, which is not just a once-off take person who walks in and spends a few hundred grand in the casino and then leaves. And there are the sort of things that they would normally do, there's a sort of information, but they actually do collect quite a lot of information for the programs because they want to market to those customers. That sort of information is also similar to the information that they would require to comply with our FICAP obligations, especially on things like address information, which currently is a requirement in terms of the regulations under the FIC Act, but in future, with the risk-based approach being implemented, will not be prescribed as a Privacy Act and these amendments would be much easier in the future. Chair, if we can take you through the reports on the rules by source, or we deal with those in the comments. But those are sort of the two key issues that we managed to carry forward in this.
Okay, so, okay, why don't you summarize what are the four issues in a nutshell? What are they?
So I think the biggest concern from the community industry was the interpretation of what is a transaction and how the fee cap applies. So that's
the legal transaction as well.
Yeah, the next one. The second one was the low value transactions and the current exemption that the casino industry has, which we said naturally would have to be reviewed and that might have to be adjusted.
Low value transactions.
And then the third one was the issue of the on-chain business relationship and how they would be able to buy the fee cap requirements in the context of the real estate approach to that on-chain relationship. Currently, they can't do because the prescriptive nature of the regulations.
Okay. Next issue.
Chair, I think that's three
main issues. Right. Let's start with the one of transactions. You're going to define transactions in such a way that it's not particularly onerous for the casinos. And it will be somewhat distinct and different from that of other sectors that you are catering for as well. Is that correct?
Pretty, yes.
Yeah. Okay. On that issue, comments, please?
Chairman, I need to be taken to the bill, clause in the bill, and I need to be shown where this is contained and how this definition is going to be differentiated between different accountable institutions. Please.
Okay, we can do it like that if you want.
Go ahead. Okay, the current Equality Act has a definition of the word transaction, which says transaction means an agreement between the institution and the customer in the nature of the institution business. We're actually proposing the deletion of that transaction because it doesn't add anything to the normal dictionary meaning of the word transaction. What this means is that when the FRC provides guidance to the casino industry, we would ask for you interpret this to mean the following in the context of your business. A transaction in the nature of casino business means a transaction in the nature of banking business means something different. That distinction would have to be clarified in guidance. Because the different categories of institutions and the vastly different ways that they do business, we can't actually kind of provide a single definition in the bill that, or the FRC Act that covers everybody's way of doing business in, and engaging with the customers.
Chairman, so essentially it's been left to the discretion of the FRC to make these differential definitions for each industry. If that is the case, how is that process? I mean, what sort of consultation will take place if there's no agreement? Who is the arbiter in this matter? You know, it should constantly be just the FIC arbitrarily deciding.
Okay.
To allow Madam Mani to use the word arbitrary if it's going to be from either
the line.
People are like, look, the rules of parliament apply. This is a democracy. People can say what they want within the rules, of course. And it's your right to say that. It's her right to have a view. So what do you want to do? Can you tell me?
The instrument that would be used to provide this sort of clarity would be guidance. It's not a rule or a subsidiary law that the FRC could make. It would be guidance on how to interpret a particular concept in the context of the FRC Act. We've, in the responses to the comments, numerous conversations raised the issue of consultation. And we've, in principle, agreed that we would propose a clause on consultation that needs to be had whenever the FRC or any of the supervisors for that matter. Develop something like guidance or make rules under the FRC Act with the affected industries or institutions. As to the arbiter and chair, in the form of guidance, guidance in itself is not a rule, so the arbiter of whether the guidance is sound to be followed would be the either a court that would have to apply the FRC Act, taking account the guidance, or a supervisor that has to apply the FRC Act. Taking account the guidance and whether they agree with the the FICs or the supervisors, implication that's put forward in guidance or not. I think in the context of how the legislation works, somebody has to make sort of a final decision or a call on what is provided for in terms of the administration of the legislation. That responsibility is with the FIC and different supervisors to deal with the implementation of the legislation.
Other jurisdictions, right? Excuse me. Really, it is a provision for a similar court, on latitude to the intelligence authority. What they do, who made the final decision? What are the differences between the counting institution and the authority? What happened?
Chair, there are two quick examples that where guidance is used quite often that I can think of. The one in Australia, the counterpart of the FIC using in Australia makes rules and issues guidance. And there's no provision on how they do it, but they, by the nature of the way the Australian system works, always do that with a lot of consultation and communication with the affected parties. But the responsibility is solely given to the outbound party in Australia. In the UK, it works differently. There's two or three different industry associations or groupings of industry associations that develop a draft guidance, and that draft guidance is then handed over to the Treasury Department in the UK. And if the Treasury Department approves the guidance, then that is formal guidance. If they don't like the guidance, they will give it back to them and say, we disagree with this, and keep going further and come back to us. So that is part of the slightly different approach where the content of the guidance is better from the industry side, where in Australia it's better from the administrative legislation side.
Given the challenges we have in our country, given the need to escalate the campaign against these crimes, financial crimes, that we should bend in the direction of saying, hey, you can consult with the accounting institution, but they can't decide. Presumably, ultimately, if the authority and the accounting institution do not agree, presumably, the accounting institution can go to a court, right? And say you're acting outside of the state statutory law, and the court will have to pass the state, right? So, I hear you out. I'm not convinced personally. I don't know what other members want to say. You can't have a co-decision-making on these issues. That's my take. I don't know what I'm feel. Let's have Olam and then
out. Okay, so around that issue, I think the Treasury could also play a role. But I think it's always best to try and resolve issues before the EAC and not speaking. The question then becomes whether you want to formalize it in terms of Treasury's role as an arbiter, or you would find ways to informally play that role. And in a way, we have done it in the past. Because usually when people are not happy, they would actually go to the minister and use that opportunity to sort of facilitate any resolution between parties. So Treasury can play a role. The question is whether do you want to formalize it or keep it informal.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that, but somebody else was going to say it. And the thing that entered my head, and this is my very subjective view, I'm not saying that the majority of parties agree with me, I think one should, as far as possible, steer away from allowing political lobbying. Because in the casino industry, you might get people who are powerful political actors. And of course, the authority acts in a particular way, then the people say, oh, I'm not happy, they're going to do wrong from the legal whatever, right? So I think one should avoid that. But on the other hand, one can't presuppose, one can't determine problems on the presupposition that will inevitably happen. Exorbitant. I'm just saying, why don't we say cautiously? You might want to ask yourself, whether you want to throw the banks to that effect, it's fine by me. I don't really respond to you either way. I just thought one of the things that entered my head was what I just did. So, in short, are we, you see, not going to spend endless hours. Because I used to Alan is here to do their job. When you start the discussion towards finalizing the call, we're not going to start all of you to say that. This is where we left off with anything new. The chair's in the room. If people are repeating what they say, the chair's room. Right. Otherwise, we're going to sit here for like 2,400 hours. This is not an intellectual, academic discussion point. This is a parliament. You make your point, you present your points of view, you hear other points of view, the chair tries to encourage the debate and discussion, but then you've got to change the problem. So as long as understood, not an intellectual seminar from university, academic environment, that's fine. So now, right now, can we reach some tentative conclusion? The assignment will note it, Alan will note it, and we go forward. To be points for now, one, a provision that says in the vote that where there is a dispute between a section of the industry.
Because that means we'll bring ministers, we'll do to the minister. That's another problem we're going to have. The minister's got a million things to do. But presumably he's worked for a retail, which is the GDQ or DGQ in this area, or advice minister. So what do you feel? I don't have a few items that have this for attention to one minor regulation. Or just you quite.
Sorry, I don't
know. You come in wherever you are. Oh, yes, I must warn you. The rules don't really allow for it. You come along with Joseph.
Yes.
All right, I'll allow some lectures and let people object to you. But, we would like to process issues and then later, I think Adam can negotiate with this woman when she can come and when not. But I'll allow it since you are here. Do you want to say, on this specific issue of whether we should put in the law a provision that says that where the disagreement sits between the casino association and the financial intelligence center, the county group, then the casino association can appeal to the minister for arbitration or settlement or resolution or agreement. Do you want to speak back?
Go ahead.
Is there
what you want to say?
I don't want to say about it. I just want to say, I want to understand if it is possible when everything is discussed and finalized without any expectations of intent in services, just like the bodies are coming together and then discuss something. Do they expect intent in terms of being success and failure of what they are discussing? Or the expectations of intent are not actually available?
No. Ultimately, no matter what we say, all the talk is actually very limited in value. What really matters, actually, is what we get done. So impacts are crucial. People love talking, including the chairperson. And they come to say, hey, chairperson, I like the way you talk. It's irrelevant. The issue really is, what is the impact of what I said or any other thing that I said here on the real world out there, which you are very much a part of? And really what happens is a good committee will ensure that it calls the executive, the government, the public, on a quarterly basis and say, this law that we have now passed, what is the effect of it? What is the result of it? We should ideally, if we had the time and the space and support service, let's start if we had support services, like of any significant or then we could also get our researchers to do some work on it. In fact, what we summit, we love getting along with what's wrong. We love speaking all the time, not just the chairperson. The real impact of a politician is what is the result out there. Do the people benefit? So what we will actually hope to do is say, when it comes to financial crime, the real value of what we're doing here is, if 2 years from now we can say, because of the changes we made to the law, the result is the following. For example, financial crime has come down. People who are more laundering money have been arrested and more importantly prosecuted, and they are in jail. So what is the result? The number of people in jail. That doesn't matter, even if you sit in court and then people are doing wrong things and they get away because they get the most expensive lawyers, right? So that's the issue. It's useless us having all these laws unless they impact. So you're absolutely right.
Right.
Having said that, what do we see? Do you want a bill, a call to be effective or not? And why? Help.
Chairman, on the surface, it would seem that perhaps we don't, but it will really depend on the clause that's going to be introduced about conversation and what that's going to be.
Chair, we can have. You know what? Why I also captured exactly what I did want to say in 2 months. One of the reasons why I'm not convinced they should get clause, you've already made a concession, this is my notion, just constantly, on contacting them. So they had advice, so to speak, at the beginning, then you introduce the particular provision, and then they also can engage with you around it and so on. So that's why I'm slightly teaching for saying you don't really need it. But I don't use phone. What if you can't do? What did you do? Do you need or don't you need? We don't need like that. Caucus study group for every decision we take. And the tentative decision is anyway, we can trust you then. Once we get around to the time and add a full list of issues, and say now that it looks like we now finally agree on what we're supposed to vote. So in short, what is the field of the committee, man? Nobody has a view. Nobody has a view. Or the three with us. Nobody has a view. Yeah, so Simon?
I think it's one quick. It's not just about
the board could share on the front, illustration by a colleague there on impact and of the issues that discussed. I think it's just a standard thing by the impact assessment, which I think is going to be a useful document in terms of holding national children and families account. Say, you said this is a potential effect from this amendment, and then later on, you can hold it from yourself, but you said these are issues that will come up, and still things are not being addressed. So that's something that touch on.
The very basic thing is, before they bring the vote to Parliament, which is very good from the Parliament, what they do is, they say, if we pass the vote or these amendments to an existing act, then the consequences of the results would be the following. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right, that's what it is, yeah.
And they've given us a copy. And he's absolutely right. If we're a good committee, we will call them here a year from now. If we're a good research support team, they will ensure we do this. They look, this is what they said, this is what they've done. You see?
And now, after all the results are seen and seeing the performance of everything concerning that thing, what happens? Do the committee again come to start to originate again the discussion or to take over or everything is cancelled?
So what we do is we actually, ideally, if we're a good committee again, we would look at the results and maybe sometime down the road, if we feel that some of the changes we make are not producing the results that we wanted, either government or parliament will propose changes. We can propose changes to them. But an individual member can also bring what you call those to parliament, an individual member from the smallest party, and say, look, I think these changes should be made. But it can only be proceeded with, it only can be processed, dealt with, if we, as a majority, agree with it. That doesn't often happen. In fact, I don't think it ever happened. Maybe once, but a little. Did come from an opposition member, and then the government itself took the content of the bill, if I recall, and made it proposals for changes to an act. Okay, the next issue then is, so we're done, right? We're not putting any provision that says what they can do it anyway. And okay, on the issue of low value transactions, what issue here?
Of consultation, and let's just take note of the promotion of the Ministry of Justice Act. If a government body or a state has this power in terms of legislation to make rules, it constitutes administrative action. If it affects the public, and then the department or institution must follow either a public inquiry or a notice and comment procedure. So there is those general consultation provisions already in the rules. I just wanted to allude to that. So if we don't put it in this initiative,
and they do use it very well, when they finance the profits or something like that. Okay, good. Our next one is over to one session.
Just a very quick picture. They're currently in litigation under the FRC Act from the Global Minister for the casino industry, setting a threshold value of R35,000 for a transaction, below which they do not have to apply the specific requirements. In this context of applying this, there's a difference approach to the FRC Act in a risk-based approach. Context, we believe that value is high. So the discussion with the consumer industry needs to be had about what is an appropriate value so that we don't really deal with true recreational damage that doesn't pose a risk, but we do apply that to make sense in itself.
Now, this is quite important regulation, so the minister can regulate that. If you don't need that member to the bill, you allow the minister to bring down the bill. I think that's fine. Anybody got any comments? I think you're right to say, let's bring it down. Okay? Anybody got any comments? No? Right, let's go to the next one. Ongoing relationships. What's the issue here?
In the majority of this, the casino does is considered one of the groups, so they don't form a long-term relationship with the customer. Except in the context where they issue loyalty cards or enroll people in loyalty programs, where they use the leadership they can do business with this customer repeatedly. In the current context, the casino industry finds it very difficult to apply the FRC Act in such a case, because they have to verify this with the credit, that's the description under the current regulations. And there's an obstacle to forming this sort of relationship with the company in the casino context. This doesn't mean that normally they want to enlarge those with into the casino if they want to gamble. In the difference, again, in the context that we're proposing now, the FRC Act will be applied under this approach, where an address would not necessarily be something that the institution would require to identify the customer. obligation with this appeal. We should open up the way for the casino industry to form this sort of relationship with the customer of life, because we have provisions in the context of where the casino establishes those relations with the customer, and the sort of information that they do collect when they form this loyalty relationship with the customer. The information that I typically include from the presentation card that gave us last week, it typically includes information about the person's occupation, where do they get the money from, because that's what they want to know, what's the source of the gambling they do, how much can they market to the person, how frequently will they see them, what sort of free offers can they provide to the person if they want to have contact with you, and things like that. So that's the sort of sufficient information to apply the relevant information in any context.
Any comments on that?
I think fine. Our big point is consultation with what I said, right? So these are the 4 points. Now, can you take us through the actual issues as they are addressed in the bullet up, the actual provisions of the clause? So the first one is clause 5, right? Here you say that you want capital readers, because I know all of us about this morning. So can we have a quick read of it?
that's very consistent with what we have discussed. Clause 58 on page 4. And other matters. B and C. I think we can use some time to look at this, but for now, I don't see anything you've done that's not reasonably clear to us. Of course, we don't really know what the costs are next, right? I mean, first thing, you're misleading us along with this. You're telling us your understanding of the meeting and agreement. What we found in Harvard, when the association is effective comes, they usually most of us say no, we never agree to the meeting, and so on. So I will see if there's some way, time, energy that I can really just change. Or ideally, I don't spend them before. Which is not to say, by the way, that if they say they're not happy, we're going to say, hey, you're not happy? No, just go back. I think we've given them, personally, I don't know, a good deal. I think that puzzles me a lot of yet again. And I'm talking to this parliament and now as well. And the raising of the terms of policy. They're requiring to resolve the issues before you're going to go to parliament. It should be how many hours to the discussion. How long are we going to talk about now? Sorry?
How much time do you think
it's going to get you to where you are? About 6 hours? We should have practiced. We ought to talk about it before the game. There's nothing that they say that's unreasonable. To the extent I understand the issue, that might be for others. Right? And there's nothing that you have done now that's not reasonable. And there's nothing unreasonable for a chair to say, how did you do these things beforehand? What is it all about? Ultimately, Parliament will decide. In the majority party, there's nothing in the Freedom Charter or the African claims that's ready to decide about what will happen to the casino industry in the year 2016. Right? So there's no like branding thing that the NEC or the NEC is going to come to us and say. So we have to shape policy as we are. Like, say what's up, love. So nothing will happen. My grandchildren will be in this parliament, the same issue. We've been trying now since 1998 with the municipal demarcation of the African rights of the issues. But still, we shall continue to try. Thank you very much for the work you've done. Thanks for this report. You're looking under very stressful circumstances. Yes, my brother.
I don't want to raise the House concern in terms of whether the cover is here. After our meeting, we actually requested them to come back and develop a document that reflects their own understanding of the meeting. So this is actually that document. So we looked at it and we were happy that it would get both sides for the
show. So tell me, what did you get for lunch? And how much more important is it to drink? I'm teasing. Where's TNT? Yeah, I was reading a friend. You know me.
I was right
there. I'm not going to put in a minute the chairperson questioned the state of sobriety of the officials, and then you guys were taking the part. And so I'm going to ask Advocate Jason, do a paper, get a chairperson, say these things in the committee, and still be taken to court. Then I have to give a mandate, who will pay for my legal fees? That's about our joke. I have done very good work. I'm very impressed. I think we all are very impressed. Thank you very much. Okay, let's look at the next one, the Law Society, you meet with them, right? I suppose that was yesterday. Right, raise the issues in a simple form and then see what happens. Is the document for that?
I'm changing so far. You
don't have a document for that, because you mentioned it yet, but...
The Law Society issues were just more or less similar to the CASA in terms of the uniqueness also of their provision. And we also agreed on discussing broad, high-level issues. First one of which was the legislative approach and also the risk management and control and compliance program. And what we agreed there was that it will still be necessary for the provision to implement this. If you recall that our concern was the fact that they were under the impression that they would have to develop a sophisticated software that is similar to any other firm or financial institution. But we assured them that they need to do the program that will reflect the nature of the business, the size and frequency also of the business they do and the type of clients that they deal with. And they have taken that very well, Chair. We also have actually indicated to them that they need to assist us by always proactively taking steps to identify the risks that are inherent in their profession that will assist when we start working on the implementation so that their input could assist the FIC when they develop the guidance as well for their profession. And also the fact that we indicated to them that we will be engaging on the process of the hazard assessment, which will also assist them in terms of identifying some areas of risk that they may not have picked up for themselves within their profession. We also discussed the same issue as well as the gospel transition, that their concern in that proposal is that they will not be able to immediately comply with the requirements in their field. And we also make the same undertaking with regard to the time frames within which we will allow them to be able to raise themselves for implementation, but that will be done similarly with their supervisory bodies, and that they will also need to start proactively developing some metrics for themselves to say how long, as far as they understand their opinion, they think they will be able to be ready to implement, so that when they have this discussion with their supervisors, they can be able to say, this is how much time we think we need. Not that we will agree to that as or take it as given, but at least it will be a good start, and it will help supervisors to be able to understand how much time it will be needed within the profession to be able to comply. We need to indicate also to the law society the fact that the kind of engagement we have with them, the kind of engagement also we need to have with our provincial supervisory bodies to be able to work towards a supervisory framework. Because the regulatory approach has completely changed how supervisor industry is now. So it will be new to them as much as it will be new to the industry. So we need to work together around that. Because the concern across the board is that we don't want to find ourselves defined for things that we thought when we develop our risk metrics, we thought were not much of a problem. And the supervisor can say no, but it's not doing it properly. So we had to give our solemn respect of that and say we need to do this with the supervisors to make sure that we are all aligned in terms of what is expected of the industry. We also discussed an agreement on the issue of guidance as well. That, given the fact that this approach is new, development of guidance by the FIC is not a central part of the implementation of the PIC. And this is something that will apply across the world and it will be just listed as well, given the differences in different industries. But also training is necessary within their profession to make sure that they train their practitioners to be able to understand the new provisions and the implications on their profession as well. And lastly, what we have the issue of also agreeing on having a joint committee between their profession and the FIC, that we start shifting work towards input into the guidance so that they can also feel that they have been accommodated. And it also, this issue links to the issue of broad consultation and the provision that we will be putting in the bill to make sure that there is general consultation across the board whenever new guidance or regulations are developed so that not that they feel that they are left out and that we obviously have in terms of building trust and also the legitimacy of the work that is being done either by the FIC or also national treasury as well. So this will be the engagement the other day is part of that ongoing engagement that we have with them. We agreed we will also develop a program of a long-term program of engagement so that throughout the life of the field in the parliamentary process and also during the implementation period, we continue to engage. And I think the idea is that some of the issues that some of the industries do reach are more related to the difficulties in implementing what is in the field, not that they are opposed to the principles of the field. So that's why we see the need to have continuous engagement so that we can hold one another's hand throughout the process. And where there's a need to, from time to time, assist one another, then we do that. That's in a nutshell what the discussions.
And we'll deal with the law society.
No.
So let's see some clarity. See, one of the things, though, is no one's questioning you. You're all doing it. If I'm in your seat, I would say the same thing. If you were sitting here, you would say this. It's a function of the law speaker today, right? Now, the one
thing we've noticed before is government departments, what they do is when they do the parliamentary process and you steer them towards consulting with stakeholders, they do it because they're the kind of the bill process. So. And then the momentum that's created gets lost because as soon as the bill has become an act, what these passports or houses, they feel they're not under the same pressure. The second point you make is that presumably you're seeing that it's in your own interest as a department
to ensure that cooperation is the fullest extent possible. Because these people feel you have a criteria. Actually, personally, I am grateful. Who cares? If people are not guilty, why would they tell you they're nothing wrong? Or the good thing is that you make this house expensive, the cost increases, it's not practical. So I think the way you are going now, I really like it. I think we all do, most of us, because everybody here, right? Just continue to do it, because you have to win them over so that you can also work with them and, you know, ensure the money is effective. The other thing I wanted to check for the purpose of clarity, just give us a sense, we're politicians, so we can work on about it. We don't need it. See, firstly, presumably before you wrote the bill, you consulted with supervisory bodies of the different sectors, right? So in the case of the law society, who is the supervisory body? And why did the supervisory body raise these issues with you? The next issue is one of the things that struck me, right? They say, hey, you know what, you must also think about a single lawyer, so the single PA, maybe an extension. How are they able to do this, which required also the biggest institution or law firm, the biggest company? So presumably they are covered because you're going to have some creation or some, let's say, standard, or I don't know what the word is, some variety that takes account of the different categories of lawyers. How are you dealing with that? Then, when you say that now that you're having a risk-based approach, what's going to happen is the supervisory bodies, they will have to, like, be much more attuned to the new dispensation. They work with magnitudes. Explain to me how that happens, why, and what will they actually do? And then I'll throw it open. I'm just taking time with some members, at least, well, the chair person understands fully what you think, then you can throw it open.
I'll also ask the staff to come on how they will enforce the space market.
Question on the issue of the consultation with the legal profession in the development process of legislation. There was a consultation process with the supervisory bodies. In the case of the law, legal profession, the supervisory bodies are provincial law societies. That is sort of a unique situation for the legal profession compared to all the other institutions that fall under their budget, because they supervise, they also the self-regulator and also their lobbying group. And also they protect the profession, advocates for the profession, but also supervise the profession. And that's the nature of self-regulatory body. So they were actually consulted twice, with on one hand in the context of consulting the profession, and those sort of bodies represent the profession, and in the different instance as a supervisor with the law society. I think in the context of understanding how supervisors will apply how they do the supervision, especially with legal profession, there will have to be a lot more engagement between the FIC and other supervisors and the provincial law societies, because this is a different mode of working to what law societies are used to doing. Law societies are used to react on individual complaints by clients and members of the public in relation to the conduct of an attorney. This is a different nature of supervision, where they won't necessarily have to have a complaint, but they would have to proactively check what the profession is doing or their members are doing. So I think there is a lot of peer learning, I think, that needs to be done, and the FIC has created a forum where the different supervisors interact, where they sit together around the table from all the different categories of our institutions and discuss these things. And the key issue in that discussion now is how the supervisor is best approach. The leader is then, virtue of experience is the Reserve Bank that has done this much more than any other thing, most of us can learn from. In the context of the small single practitioner or the large firms, in the current FIC Act dispensation, there is an exemption for the legal profession to apply the FIC Act only in relation to specific types of business that an attorney firm would do, setting up companies, doing property transfers, raising capital, doing corporate business, and things like that. Everything else that in the profession is exempt from the FIC Act. And the discussion that we've had with the attorney's profession even before the legislation coming to Parliament is that once a profession to think about meeting is what is the scope of the FASI Act, OA, for the business that happens within the law firm, and what part of the law firm's business should be covered by the FASI Act, and what can we leave out. So not necessarily to say if you're a small practitioner, you will not be affected by the FASI Act, because if you're a small practitioner that only practices in transferring property, then your whole business will be subject to the FASI Act. But if you're a small practitioner that only has bail applications for persons that appear court for the first time, you will never be affected by the FASI Act, because that part of the business is checked out by your exemption. So it is the purpose of this exercise to understand what part of the legal profession should be of concern when we think about the FASI Act and the objectives and apply to that, whether you're a small practitioner or not. In the context of this risk program and the compliance of the internal structures of the institution, we can go through that to reflect the business. So if it's a small business, one or two squad members, then the internal rules on that we have to come in, because they would have to do with the structure of that institution. But they would then have to say what is it the institution does to identify customers or to spot suspicious behavior by a customer or those sort of things that they have to comply with.
Another view, if I understand you, it's not just hiring. Not size of the company, it could be a single person. It's the nature of the transaction. It's the nature of the client. So if you have a big transaction, though you're a small office, you will be subject to people. It could be a big company dealing with issues that are not any consequences. Okay.
Yeah, that, you said that in the beginning. It's
interesting. I don't know why you guys all, it's also quite achieving a book. It's also shaping discourse. You know, you have to, especially when they are all here, both sides, you know, and you will save us a lot of time. I think you should be proactive. This committee, you know, well, this is what I'm here. You can speak your mind, and you can also tell the chairperson, you know, if you're talking nonsense, I'd pull this. I'd rather that than waste your time. So shape the discourse. There are things you should intervene in the strategic moment. If you do later, you waste a lot of time, and also, sort of being outmaneuvered by the discourse, whether it's where yours is the article, right? Who would you with Alpha? I mean, with Alpha, do they think? So, who is this?
Yeah,
oh, you just ask the
front to come in.
So, this you can't do. In other words, when you say to the chairperson, ask him to speak, right? Maybe he's sort of that, he's when I speak in particular, he needs more rigorous with me. I don't know how to learn and grow. Okay, I have learned, right? So you must also educate me. If they don't want to be educated, it's fine. You tell me, hey, Jefferson, you're just wrong. I don't mind. I prefer that than being media and being correct. But because, you know, you see, you can't say it's the committee. There's only parliament that says you cannot engage legally as department officials with the committee. There's no ruling parliament that says you cannot point out to members of parliament that they are wrong. There's no rule. I don't have any rule. Do you know any of that rule? No. So please engage more. And even cut me short. A lot of you are in the team. Cut me short. You see, I have a danger. Let's take time. But let's also learn and grow. Right, go.
So, Chair, before Stephen comes in, we are chosen to reach out to Chair, so we have been thoroughly trained in respecting protocols.
Show me the rules which say that right now, this is the committee you're dealing with. And other departments have done it, exactly. Especially the whole COGDA. But as you say, local government. So, let's not. Just do it. Just do your job.
Thanks, Shane, and good morning to everyone. I think mine is a simple one, just to explain how things are going to change going forward in terms of supervising accountable institutions under the risk-based approach. I think currently, accountable institutions are supervisors when they supervise the CH. It's a simple exercise. Just looking at the rules. The role of where you are, you know, you have to obtain identity documents, to verify the identity of the client, whether to obtain the proof of reference or the letter you decided last week from your friend, your local counsel. And that's what we do, and then we look at whether you've submitted to such and joint transactions to consistency and to do this. So that's how it's simple. That is why the rules case and which is the box and have that. If you don't have that, we put into a program to make sure that to evolution where we want you to be clean. Another space, things are going to change slightly. There are no rules that define how you identify clients. So you have to develop based on the risk that we believe we are exposed to. But that framework will have to be a framework that we develop and a framework that share with the supervisor. The supervisor is head with that framework. This is done now all over the world. If the supervisor is head with that framework, the supervisor will then assess you according to that framework. So because the supervisor is heavy, that if somebody is working for government and that person is the head of department and you regard that person as high risk, and the supervisor is happy with that. So then it will be in the and you don't make that in your program. The supervisor will have to supervise or assess you according to your program. But if your program is then, you know, it says that person is low risk, and the supervisor is not happy with that, then the supervisor can say, my friend, now I do not agree with your assessment of your risk. You cannot say a person that works in the government, you know, that's got so much influence and you know, holding such a prominent position, you say it's low risk, but I only take a driver's license, no proof of residence. So those are how the supervisor will go about. But the supervisor would also encourage and make sure that accountable decisions and make sure that they have risk assessments concerning being reviewed, make sure that it's aligned to the current situation. So it doesn't mean you have the risk base in 2016, 2020 you should be using the same framework. So that's the role of supervisor. But the risk base also says between the FIC and the supervisor bodies, there needs to be a lot of engagement and also a lot of guidance that the issues of industry, because there's a lot of gray area in terms of the risk-based approach that is there, because the rules are not made for you. You have to develop your rules. We only develop the framework and the principles that we need to develop your own rules. So the balance from our side will be very key, especially for institutions that are small. It doesn't mean that we don't have banks that are small. We also have banks that are very, 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 very small, but they have their program will have to be proportionate to that thing. So, if I take, for instance, Standard Bank's program will not be the same as a program of a smaller bank. So that's how we do that report.
Okay, thanks. Over to you, members. Okay, just want to be glad to clarify. Over and above the issues you addressed with CASA, when it comes to the Law Society, is there any other issue specific to them that you addressed? Or you think they're covered in the formulations you've got for CASA?
To a great extent they are, but we still acknowledge the fact that they have their own uniqueness as a profession, given the fact that there is some of the issues in their submissions that, for instance, you know, with the definition of flying, sometimes those who operate child accounts and, you know, and also in the property transferring business where sometimes money is deposited not by the client but by the other party who's not necessarily a client. So those are some aspects that we sought to address also by dealing with the removal of the definition of the client, for instance. So hence our indication that between us and them is an ongoing discussion that we need to have. What is important is a general understanding that we cannot have a blanket way of the requirements of the bill, that they need to be applied but proportionate to the nature of the business that they operate. So some aspects are not necessarily similar to casinos, because they do have clients that they deal with and they build their relationship with. And with the legal profession, then the nature of the relationship with the client also can change continuously. Because today is like I'm seeing and want you to do this transaction, but the next day it's a different kind of business. So that business relationship and the continual due diligence also is different also from what would be the case in the casino situation. I don't know if I remember this one.
Okay, fine.
Any
comments yet, David?
Just so that I can be so that we can make this concrete, given your discussion with the Law Society, what exactly are the implications for this bill? What in your view needs to be amended and or changed? Trying to allocate responsibilities better.
Just a big thinking, and we'll actually have a discussion with.
nothing to be specific in the bill that we have amended now. I think much more of this is about the guidance and the engagement of the profession subsequent to the passing of the legislation, especially around the identification of the relevant part of the profession that should be subject to the bill and what could be anything.
Yeah, I understand that, right? Am I correct? And there was only three coming, right? Because, you know, we're really keen on getting some independent view apart from political views being expressed in these, right? So please kind of, what I understand now is we recognize the diversity of the industry panel. We also recognize within the sector of the industry, there's also diversity. We've agreed that there's no complete waiver. I like that term. What there are exemptions of different sorts. Apart from exemptions, there's also transitional provisions. So if I understand the whole dispensation, what we're going to have is the minister being allowed to regulate means certain provisions of the Act come into effect. Those are general provisions, ones. It'll apply to every institution in the industry. There may be such general provisions. So the minister might say, President's promulgated the Act, but the Act only comes into effect, these clauses only come into effect, they're generally called 6 months from now. Then there's another area in which we are doing exemptions and transitional provisions. We're saying that these clauses, this or that industry is exempt from, for a certain period. So in other words, only, for example, that section will be exempt for 6 months, maybe another 12 months, but other sectors will have to apply for them immediately, right? There's another category. There's a third categorization of within the sector. You might have a small entity as against a big entity that's partly covered by the risk-based approach. But over and above that, for practical reasons, you might have to say, small companies don't require certain things, a big company, or small transactions don't require any action on, but big transactions is required. What are other things that are contingent and dependent? That's a set of issues, am I correct? What you have to help us with is when they come with the next text of the bill, with the amendments to the amendments, right, is to check that what they have done, and I think this can help us, is what we have guided them in terms of policy on, so they don't give undue exemptions or they're not unduly restrictive. That is something you have to help us with, Sumasani and Africa Chair. Is there
again, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, I agree with you that, for example, exemptions would be a function of regulations issued by the minister. Is that correct, or would exemptions be provided for in practice notes, or are those two different instruments?
Okay, formal exemptions from compliance day, but that is granted by the minister. The Parity Fashion Act has that provision in the Act that gives the minister the power to make exemptions. And they can make general exemptions, you can make specific exemptions for specific individual units, specific institutions. And you can check any conditions to the exemption that you think is appropriate, given the time period or compliance, particular secondary obligation, etc. So the minister has quite a wide authority under the Government Act to make exemptions. There is a caveat that the exemptions that are made must be done in consultation, and that's where we have replaced the current provisions on the council that being revealed with something else that the minister would have to meet as part of the consultation process to make exemptions.
Okay. Right, let's move on then. So we covered at least two policy issues. Right? Now we're going to close the calls. Is that right? Now, long as you've got a bit of proposal, anybody else? No? Right, let's go for it.
So now, I think we are looking at the
response by National Treasury and Financial Intelligence, and the comments are limited to this. This is your final text, right? Now, this text, you've been through. Well, you've only got it this morning, it's unfair. So we can give you 48 hours. And it's tomorrow is the financial sector regulations, all right? So by Friday, you can go through it. If there are things that you and your team, Sean and Brandon, have picked up, that actually would
presented to the public here that are not being responded to by Treasury, then you will put them in traction, right?
I think it's intended for you to help.
I don't know what they think. But we've got a bit of a view, right? So up to next week. Even Monday morning is reasonable. Like, what about Monday morning? We don't even have a huge pressure to the sun. That we have a deadline of Monday, 3:00 by which time you'll have responded to something. Does that sound reasonable? Let's go for it. The first point here. I take us through it. Are you all on your way?
Sir, I'm going to ask the FIC just to take us to the cost by clause. Will she be more appropriate?
Can you find the general comment, right? And then we will section B cost by clause. Then how is it done?
Yeah.
The first section is up to page, what is it? Up to page, oh, you've got how is it done? It's slightly different from. Alright, well, we'll take it for a second. How did you say in the same place?
Good.
We can see the second. Say the comments. I'm not going to say this, just to get from the... The first one of those, which actually is from quite a few of the presentations, is about the current state of the, or the state of the current regulations and exemptions post the implementation of the new amendments they've got here. And this is, as we've explained, for large portions of current regulations are incompatible with those basic approach. They would have to be reviewed. There are large sections of the regulation that is described in a lot of detail that institutions must do to identify customer and how they must verify customer's identity, what information they must get, how they must keep records. So actually regulating is quite a level of detail what institutions must be doing. Those must coexist with those basic approach. So specific requirements of seeing an identity document to verify a person's identity or obtaining and verifying an address disappear from the current legal framework with the withdrawal of these regulations. Similarly, as I explained just a bit earlier on exemptions, we will have to review the exemptions that are currently provided for. Some might continue in a different form and a large portion of those again would be withdrawn, which is not to say that the institution would not be allowed to do what exemption currently provides, but they would just take responsibility for managing the risk in their own business in accordance with their framework.
Boring now. Anything else?
time. Also, we will be efficient in terms of any international obligations that apply to the country if we don't do such a risk assessment, which we would not risk exposing the country to. However, we don't necessarily agree that it's a wise approach to write the requirement for such an approach into the legislation, because that solidifies the structure through which it should be done, which may not accord with the way that government structures currently function or may change in future. So we prefer sort of flexibility for government to arrange the way that it is done and who, which parties and structures are involved in that process. But we would confirm that there is no way that we would allow the act to proceed without a structure being put in place that would expose us to international criticism, not to say we need to affect the implementation of the legislation itself.
I think you should put in the act itself as well. And you're saying you're doing it anyway, and you don't need it in the book. That's what the issue is. And you say you can't not do it. Because, you know, you told them not to risk and, hey, you know, why would they risk it then in the first instance? It doesn't make any sense. I'm sure they know that.
Because it's more to what we think it's general recognition that for the need for such an assessment and for the communication of the results of such an assessment, an industry would feel more comfortable if they know that there's a law somewhere that says it must be done. I think that the only response we can offer is we would undertake that this will have to be done. We cannot fund the act, and we would have to waste all the time in the effort of amending the act without such an assessment. But the way that government undertakes these things is done in the particular structure on the, and in relation to cabinet committee and so forth, and involves different departments involved in the process. If we do something in a legislative piece of legislation, it can be only a very generic clause, which is not really consequential in terms of legislation, can't be enforced, doesn't that really the necessary impact of making sure something happens as well, and it is happening.
Any comments from
you?
Sorry, you want to say
good morning, everyone. I'm Carmeline Nadu, and here from Barca. On the national risk assessment, just to clarify, the comment that we put forward from the industry perspective is the risk assessment needs to be done at a country level, it needs to be done at a sector level, and after that, it is done at an institution level. So the comment that we put forward is simply that in order for the sector and for the institutions and within the sector to be able to conduct a proper and well-informed risk assessment, that sector would need the output of national risk assessment. In terms of the bottom comment, there was no specific request that this be set out in legislation. It's a clear comment which reflects that it's the national risk assessment that would inform the sector's decision.
Just a quick comment on that one. I think this is one area of government we sort of take responsibility. We should have probably done the assessment some time ago. It is a complex process because it does require consideration in terms of various departments who could play a role. So it does require some time in terms of putting the structure together. And yes, we do feel that might not necessarily be the case that it should be expected into legislation. So I think as government, we do commit that we'll try and fast-track this risk assessment. But having an explicit clause in the Act requiring such an assessment, we feel could be a bit superfluous. Because once we've done the assessment, in a way, the provision does become very superfluous. So we can give our hope that we'll try and give respect to this risk assessment as soon as possible.
I think that's a point I want to having an understanding of risk at the national level and communication of indicators that flow from that to the industry is not a sine qua non. It's not an absolute requirement before an institution can do their own risk assessment. I think it definitely adds to the quality and the value of an institution's risk assessment, but I don't think an institution is prevented from doing an assessment, understanding its own business and its own customers, at least without
that's not only a paragraph, right? Which Bintani and his team are looking, staying on the floor of Parliament. We kept the dumb in the world, we kept your arguments, we kept what Bafa is saying, but that you would do it within a reasonable time, right? And we might ask them to be tabled or something, we can talk about that later. So I'm putting here point 5 of your notes, and that's going to list this thing. Next point, 6.
On the talks disagreement, so that on the diversion of industry and national risk assessment is very important function and would assist sectors and institutions in their own risk assessment. So I'd like to create an obligation on the executive to carry out national risk assessment. How many years has the national risk assessment been outstanding?
For a couple of years.
And let's ask to come in, and I think my colleague will also respond. In as much as the risk-based approach has been part of the recommendations, but when they revised the recommendations in 2012, then they made the risk-based approach to be the basic fundamental part of the of recommendations. That when at that point, one would say countries needed to start doing their national risk assessment based on the revised recommendations. Now, I must say that the national risk assessment is something that the broader membership of FATF also does acknowledge the challenges around it as well. It's not just under South Africa. And it has to do with what it takes to be able to do a proper risk assessment in terms of resource mobilization, in terms of the product coordination of it. So it's actually a few countries in the world, and I can confirm that, that have been able to successfully do it. And I think in Africa, I think of two countries, Malawi and Namibia at the moment. So it's a very expensive and also costly exercise. And we are not saying because of that we will not do it. I think we have to do it. It's important that we do it to be able to assist our industries to strengthen their own
I think just to add one additional point, if government undertakes an assessment local, when this process is launched, it will not only for the benefit of institutions, it's for the benefit of government making some decisions based on each findings and each understanding of risk and how it decides to mobilize a particular leg of the investigative arm of government, for instance, to focus on specific crimes or whether to allocate resources in identifying or setting up better companies, better discrimination, whatever the case would be. So it's also for government to properly reorganize its resource allocation to address what it's trying to show. From that process also follows information that must be communicated to the industry, but it's not done for the benefit of the industry alone. And that's why we give a firm understanding that it has to be done. Raymond is correct, in terms of our peers in the country, the financial action task force that have done this, less than half of the countries have been able to actually complete this assessment. The UK has published a public version of their assessment about 3 or 4 months ago, for the first time ever that they've actually done this. So this is a very difficult process, and because it has to be in the government, it has to be part of government business.
It's not that government has not had any discussion on this issue. We might not have discussed formally as a national risk assessment item, but there have been several discussions. For example, NICOP coordinates a number of departments around some of the issues, and they have been working towards developing some kind of a national security strategy. So there has been some discussion. It has not per se been focused on the national risk assessment, but one can easily build up on those discussions, and I think that's where the discussion will be heading to. But it is a complex process, so it does require buy-in from a number of key players.
Chair, obviously the committee will try, but
given the fact that the FAP recommendations sort of recommend a national assessment, given the fact that we're 3 years behind, and given the fact that Malawi and Namibia are ahead of us, I would suggest that we create a provision in the legislation, which actually would advantage not just industry, but would actually advantage the FIC, because it would put pressure on inefficient institutions like NECA to which could barely run a boss, to get going and make sure that these risk assessments are completed and updated regularly.
I don't want to say I'm just worried about the fact that she pulls down talking all the time. But I'm trying to facilitate the discussion, but not much input from members. But also maybe to call for a meeting, except that these people are flowing in from Florida, and I don't know where else. If you would keep something, actually I would go, there's no point in pitching in a meeting, that's only about sitting up a proper position. Because I don't know what it is. Yes, but we're not getting to use a lot of, so you're speaking for yourself and your party presumably. I'm looking for responses, because nobody gives a response. So, okay, we'll table this issue, and we'll see how far we go, because I don't know what my dad thinks is a response. Do you have any view of it? Because I don't know what we're going to do. What am I supposed to do? From what I can just ask you a few questions. One of them would be, in the more established or developed countries of the North, so to speak, do they actually, do they do their national risk assessments before they pass their votes around these issues? Because today, like the UK, US today actually. Secondly, wouldn't that be reasonable to say that certain countries in the developing world are small? Their financial sector is far less complex than South Africa's. So the fact that they have done it doesn't necessarily mean we do it, given the. I mean, from what I know, our financial sector is fairly good as a whole. Our banking institutions are regarded as one of the top 10 in the world and so on and so on. So you get a small country with a relatively rudimentary financial sector, understanding also because of the GDP and size, physical size of the world. I don't know that you can just use these comparisons so crudely, in my opinion. So if you could respond to the two questions, I think we'll leave it in advance because there's no response from other members, and I don't know what we do. Other options to call up a meeting if you're not getting a participation. That's what I'm supposed to do as a chair.
I think that's just a different very subject, which attends, you know, depends on how you get it. I think the question I just want to put or comment on about to industry and the literature, I think you kind of cover some of the aspects. What are the implications if you have it, if you don't have it, just referring to the country, what are the implications? I mean, we don't have it. What implications on the industry from the center, personal control, what benefits are there? But like benefits, and like say, there's a subjective issue or friendship effect. You don't have a system which has been emphasized to meet the expectations. So I'm just trying to say, from the center, what are the implications of not having or having the restrictions?
I think Peter actually put it closely when he said that this is not a prerequisite to applying the Act, but the important
risk assessment in terms of some blind spots in the event that their own risk assessments have not picked up some areas. But as it says, the Act or the bill will be able to be implemented in its current form. Other countries that have not done it, it does not mean that they do not have the MLCFT framework. They do have, but they haven't yet done the additional risk assessment. And like you correctly indicated as well, Chair, that we need also to look at the nature, size, type, and also sophistication of our organ and cell sector, which may not necessarily be the same as other sister countries also in the SADC region as well. So let me say that they are not... Yes, I was not going to mention that. And I was about to also mention the fact that without necessarily saying they are not sophisticated. Of course, it is a point you make which I may not need to repeat as well.
For entities in the industry saying, so I don't do this because it suits them.
no one to write guidance from the government party to introduce an event, whether we want something in the world specifically. And if we should say something, presumably that's some sort of Islam. May I ask a practical question? How far are you in this process? You see, because you've been trying to allow me to see that there are elements of it there, which you haven't looked at it coherently. It could be asked by a committee member, and it's, I think, you know, anyway, why did you do at least the rudiments or the outlines or some proper naturalistic system to pull up, pull to us, you know, more clearly emphasize about what exactly we should put in the book. That's a reasonable question to ask. Which is a secular thing of saying, because you don't have it, therefore, hey, how are you going to get an executive book? So a separate thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think first it's something that work has already started and is underway on this issue of risk assessment, or at least comprehensively understanding risk from a money laundering fair financing point of view. But most of the work so far has been on the closer side to understand what is the best structure and means for government to institutionalize such process, not on the back of actual assessment itself. We've, as FIC, I've sat over the past 2 years, I've hosted workshops, at least two, with the potential help that will have to contribute to such an assessment process to understand whether they understand what it means and whether they have an appetite to become part of this. And there has been discussions in the NECOP context, which undertakes threat assessments, which is slightly different from the understanding of risk. How to integrate this process with the sort of national threat assessment process. So that work that has been happening in the last few years. I currently have a draft of a memorandum that will go to the minister to take to cabinet to give more structure and institutionalize this process. So that's the next step in the process that we have to now undertake in the next two, next month or two, to do sort of give a sound, high level government platform for the future functioning of the risk assessment process. Rainbow Citizen Direct and others that have said it, it's no one of exercise. Once you do it, it's an institutional process of government.
Okay, Olana, you'll say it again? Alright, so the committee will decide in due course whether we're going to put something in the bill or not. The other option is you don't put something in the bill, you put it in the report. It does not have the legal binding nature of what's in the bill, but it's an activistic committee. We will hold the committee to account within 6 months and raise the progress and so on. I don't actually have a view, by the way. I don't feel strongly guided by the members of the committee when they're putting themselves to say anything at all. The next point is 6.
Thank you, Chair. A number of the comments have made the point that the requirements that are provided for in the bill go further than the current international standards in the Financial Action Task Force recommendations. In some sense, this is one of the issues that is still up for discussion at the meet later this week with a banking institution on it to get a clearer understanding of the fiscal business rules that approach the debate. But I think just to confirm at this point, from our perspective, the specific provisions where there's a lot of detail besides in the bill, for instance on beneficial ownership or on prominent persons, we've tried to stick as close as possible to what the current international standard recommendations say, and we've in some cases almost word for word copied, so that we are sure that our obligations are comparable to what international standards and our international counterparts will be implementing on those issues. For the rest, we've tried to stay within the confines or not exceed the international standard. The one area where our legislation is going further than the international standard, that's been the case since the one when the EBUS Act was promulgated, is in relation to small transactions, where we don't prescribe a threshold below which an institution does not have 13 points customer. We require that for any small transaction, regardless of that.
client is important position, it's a cash-based economy. Rather more than most IOUs, the northern countries.
That's right, Chair.
And
so that would mean that a large proportion of companies would not be identified if they say, which great blind spot do you have to cover the light?
Oh, right, okay. May I just comment, please? Well, this is obviously subject to the discussions you're having with FIFO. Still, the committee can guide you and suggest to you what for now we think are the parameters. And we've covered it now, but is there anything else to do with that? Now, on the threshold thing, can people comment on that? Thanks for the considerable cooperation, Liz. It's really helpful. Let's focus on either of those issues. The issue here is, since we're getting no guidance, the chair is suggesting that actually maybe, it's worth looking at that. I didn't give you a promise to thank you, sir. But given we're getting no guidance from committee members, I will only suggest to you that you take into account, actually. So what you do is the payroll level can be adjusted by the minister in consultation with them, right? To some extent, it's consistent with the earlier discussions we've had. That's my feeling as long as you give me strong arguments against that, then I will change my view. Right? I'm not stuck with it. I want to hear a rigorous, vigorous response. And then I say, okay, I'm wrong, I was wrong.
If you're thinking along the same lines, but if such a threshold provision is accommodated, it would be done in a way that where the minister can flexibly change the threshold from time to time. And we would not use the current international standard as a guidance, because if we use our exchange rate in 50,000 euros and dollars amount, it's fairly significant transactions. It's not, in our context, low value transactions anymore. So we would set a much lower threshold than that before, and by the minister set a lower threshold if such a provision.
Just along like inflation will come in, how will it impact on a foreign, he or she comes in? I mean, really, today you've got US dollars and UK sterling and euros and so on. It's a small amount for you from outside the country. I don't know what it means, whether you have two different categories, what's the threshold and so on. I don't know how it works. Foreign people who visitors, tourists, and the like. So, do you want to respond to the issues that we see what members views are?
Chair, specifically on the issue of foreign citizens doing business in the country, if they do business with the institution, they have to meet the obligation of the act, and they have to identify that person. In the current framework, they have to know the person's name and identity, and they have to confirm that by reference to the person's passport or some sort of official document that contains the same information. So that's the type of regulation detail that will disappear. But the institution still has the obligation to know who they're doing business with if they have a foreign visitor. Who does business in the regulated environment? So if the person wants to open a bank account, whatever the case might be, the bank still has to identify that person.
Okay, what's
your name?
Right,
let's
move on. We have this issue we need for you to report back on that one. Then point 7.
Chief, thank you. Point 7 is a general comment that the implementation of a legislative code should add to the compliance burden of institutions. And I think we essentially agree, it does make compliance more complex for complex institutions. Especially the homework and the preparatory work that needs to be done to properly implement the legislative code on an ongoing basis. So we're not claiming that it's easier or cheaper to apply a legislative approach, but what it does allow institutions more flexibility to decide where they might spend the time and effort and resources and where they don't have to. And also allow institutions to make better decisions about how they engage with their customers and not put their customers to unnecessary requirements to provide them with useless information, such as address specifications and things like that.
Any comment on this? So we're probably doing it today, attending your discussions is something new emerges. I think really, I think there's something new to say. Okay, next one.
Chairman, may I ask if proposals for a preamble will be added to the bill? Frankly, we don't really see the need for a preamble since the purpose of the Act is to bring it in line with the international standards, or at least one of the objectives, and that's spelled out in the memorandum of objectives. But generally, an amendment bill So we haven't seen, I don't think any country has such studies being undertaken or compared. One of the challenges we don't actually know what the costs are until institutions start implementing this cost, we can guess what cost might be or whether that where cost might have to be spent or not necessarily the quantity. The cost of compliance has been the issue under debate from the early days of the implementation of the FRC Act. The current FRC Act costs institutions a lot of money to implement. And as I say, we're not saying that these changes reduce that cost. I think that the challenge in quantifying the cost of compliance, though, is that institutions, that especially large institutions, banks, insurance companies, etc., that implement these measures, implement the same measures to achieve other objectives, not just compliance with the FRC Act. It's hard to quantify what is purely compliance with the FRC Act and what is general run of the business overage of cost of the business. And when we prepared the bill for cabinet and we had to prepare an impact study to go with it, we faced the same challenge that it's very difficult to actually currently quantify the current cost of compliance and to get that information from industry. We government would know what it costs unless industry funds. So it's a challenging question. We've not seen any studies of countries that have actually compared the cost of compliance before and after these other amendments.
What the US UK?
Why do you demand so much of South Africa and living democracy? The country has in the US and the UK countries. But here is your right to ask this question. What I'm trying to say is, you know what, on the one hand it is fair for we pay for some investigation. Bring those to Parliament without excessive warnings, the cost implications for the state of implementing these bills, and these days from the end of the state have to be open. What about passing all these bills? Wonderful bills that they are, and then state can implement it, okay? Now, the latter has still not really been done, although I see the regulation impact, but there's slightly different things from practical implementation. Now, on the issue of financing, if we ask that of the government, the executive, the Parliament, tell us what the consequences of financial are for the state to implement. It's also reasonably fair of the public civil society stakeholders, business unions, to ask, you want us to do all the things, what is the cost? So it's not so typical of access to the for us to be able to say, this is what the cost of state is easier than it would be to say, look, what the cost of private taking institutions, especially reliance on their most. So I accept that. But the question also is, you're saying that some of the things they do, they have to do anyway. Some of the things they do to meet the requirements of the Act will benefit them and make them more efficient. Some of the things they do now will actually reduce costs. Presumably also there's an obligation to help them to coordinate and use systems, and I don't know what they do on that performance in the program and so on, that they're reasonably harmonious in the system and so on. So you can try to do what you can to assist them to make it cheaper to implement the system. Yeah, all right. Can I have one question later? Do you know anything? What is the profit margin of financial institutions, I suppose it's first, like in this country and against other countries? In other words, do they make more profits than they do in established democracies or the other comparable developing democracies? Do you have it?
Not sure. We haven't done specific work around that. But generally speaking, and if you were to use various instruments, so for example, how banks shares perform on the JSE, I think you could fairly say they are reasonably profitable institutions. And there's nothing wrong. there's nothing wrong with that. You do a reasonably profitable institution because in the absence of them, then you won't have the industry, which plays quite an important role in terms of intermediating capital. So, Chair, we haven't done a thorough study, but given the performance of financial institutions' shares and the return on equity, they do seem to be reasonably profitable.
I was looking around and saying they are amongst the top globally, and rate of return on the investment. But they make it easy to us a big deal. They won't die. In the group time.
Sorry?
What did you say? Yeah. Yeah, that's correct, I suppose. You're talking about what I mean. See, reasonable could mean if you're a Marxist, you might think. If you're a free market, you might think. If you're an anarchist, you might think. If you're a liberal, you might think what's reasonable. Alright, so something to help us. But they're not statistics available. Like, there are some things you read in business day and business reports that tell you certain companies are doing extremely well by global standards. Like, I know, for example, rate of return on investment in agriculture is very low. Globally. But in this country, it's, you know, I read a business report and that's it. That's why I went long to go. But I don't know, there's not no statistics available. I can't accept it. Over to you, Mr. Zani, can you help us with this?
Thank you, sir. I think the aspect is quite interesting because again, the challenge that the unjust consumer protection approach can actually shorten the floor. And I think this discussion here will close down to the topic for tomorrow, which, you know, to get to the results today, you know, investment claims, cost inflation, the challenge ratios, you know, so there's going to be a very, very interesting discussion. And I looked at the impact assessment that's done by emissions. And I think maybe we should have a discussion with the session, which I'm not convinced by the document.
We're going to ask you to take us through the document, and then next time we are here. Can you take it? I'm sure that he does. Give him 15 minutes to take us through it.
The last point in that aspect, that I think the qualification comes from other ways that it could be due to institutions some products to write a position, you know, so just to manage the qualification, the cost of certain products and qualification will high. So I think that in our aspect as well, we did something in terms of product and whatever else. I think also the industry should really stop saying the cost of this is come up to say what they need at the end of the country, it's going to cost you more. We have to make a committee, we have to make a decision to say that. And I think, you know, that discussion should really come to this.
So just a quick point, I think as far as we do acknowledge that regulation does mean compliance costs. And that's the first point to me. But certainly, you know, given that this is the financial sector, and yes, LCFG goes even beyond the financial sector, there is merit in terms of having sound regulation. And as we have indicated, we have fallen a bit behind in terms of those international standards. The third point to make, Chair, is that ideally, hypothetically, with a risk-based approach, you should end up with a situation whereby most of your resources are focused on what we call high-risk individuals or activities. So effectively, you should put more resources where you feel there's higher risk and therefore free resources for areas where you might not be experiencing the same type of risk. So in a way, that should assist in terms of how the industry faces your sort of low income individuals. And I think this is one of the questions which was asked, which Raymond will try to ask, sorry, to address, which the chair you asked last time in terms of what are the implications for financial inclusion. And as we think, so by having a risk-based approach, you are able to facilitate some form of financial inclusion. There is a good chance, Chair, during the uptake, you will see some costs going up because institutions will have to upgrade their systems. But hopefully that will taper off as the risk approach is embedded in the system. The fourth point, which is not a fifth, is that one needs to balance compliance cost with reputation cost. So, Chair, you would have seen some of the heavy fines which have been imposed on international conglomerates, etc. And those do have reputational implications on institutions. I think it is a fair point to make that yes, there could be compliance costs embedded, but those should be seen in the context of being able to comply and avoiding a situation where you could be fined, because that then introduces reputational cost and implications for the institution.
Okay. Yes, it specifically on the issue of cost, and I'm interested to hear from industry whether they've conducted the ownership system, whether they have any views on what the cost of implementation would be and what and how the rules should possibly give them to share cost.
Thank you. We don't have actual information from members, but it's very difficult to calculate that for the bullet implementers. You know that their system changes are going to be expensive, but you know you don't have actual quotes because you need to give them the details of types of fields and types of changes that will happen. So it is very difficult to quantify for the actual finalization of the details. But obviously, with certain measures, that's why where a lot of comments come from, is to say it needs to be automated as much as possible. Then obviously reduce costs, so that kind of thing. That PDM management not to be involved too much, because that obviously also increases costs. So, you know, just general measures like that will go a long way. The storage of records, storage costs a lot, so how records need to be stored, do actual physical documents need to be kept, or can be kept electronically, all of that kind of thing. So a lot of the detail will depend on what the costs are. Thanks.
Data for fun. Okay.
The next issue then is now we're on look, on this issue of cost, right, I don't think there's much that committee can do. Oh, yes, you want to say something?
Yeah. Just to respond to the issue of cost from a boss perspective, the information has been requested from the industry, and yes, it will take some time to quantify the actual cost. But the early indications are that implementation costs would run into hundreds of millions of pounds.
Would that reasonably, well, would that be a reasonable fee to order on reply and be something you took into account?
The approach we took also, if you look at our socio-economic impact assessment, we do acknowledge that it's an area that there is that possibility of cost being higher, but our view is that as it happens in the early stages of putting together systems and with regard to also the risk assessment by industry in developing their own risk matrix. But our view is that going forward, you know, the picture will be completely different, and that's where also we see the opportunity for financial inclusion, because there, in essence, we are saying that some rules that would have otherwise applied in some areas will then be relaxed, because the industry will have the discretion based on their risk management program. They will then determine that this event is lower risk, and therefore they will not have a need to implement certain requirements. So that's where we then view the cost implications being lowered, and also in having also even financial inclusion as well. So in our thing is that there is no trade-off between financial inclusion and financial integrity, in particular in SFT. It is complementary policy objectives which can coexist. So yes, in the initial stage, the cost will be high, but it also depends, because there is some work that the industry may have done in the normal business conduct of business in terms of, you know, assessing some of the risks that they give on a daily basis, that they're not necessarily to do a fresh work to comply with it.
We can't. Right. I think we've done as far as the committee can do for now. Basically, you're saying that in some senses they will save money, in other senses they will have to pay for the costs. Presumably, it's fair to conclude that the savings will be significantly less than the cost, right? So I think that on the whole, we can, even in our report and line, say that we're aware of the costs. We are
consumer will ultimately bear the cost or the cost. We appeal to Treasury to work closely. They have got several structures to bring the sectors together, different sectors. They must work with each other to cooperate. I mean, obviously competitive. To actually, there are centers in which they cooperate. I don't know how it's done elsewhere. Presumably, you can compete around profit and so on. But precisely because there's a common interest, you can work on systems and so on, simplify things. Presumably, also our earlier discussions around getting in, around transitional arrangements, around exemptions, and all that will also assist. So maybe what I take into account also in all of these things, transitional arrangements, exemptions, settling in of different problems and so on. I had a lot of problems. Should we have done our report? But what this report in this country is not meaningless. We hold before us and say, hey, these are the things we agree on. Forget the act only. This is what decisions do at the moment, so you've done. In any case, you can't be a reporter. Nothing. What have you done about? So learning now the report is that I know what they think in the civil society paper and the guy to stop right, make that for the data, right? But it's not the case. You even write me, write me a letter to the report and say, Mr. Chairperson, you say you're going to do this. I think we're right, actually. In civil society, am I? Anything we say we're going to do, nothing stops you from writing to Parliament. This is your Parliament. Let's say, Chairperson, you said you're going to do this, you haven't done it. Please feel free to do that. So what we're saying is, I do think really that one of the things you'll have to take into account, I haven't occurred to me personally before, is the cost. The other thing that worries one is, given the economic challenges at the moment, given 0.7% growth rate, it's not the best time to be imposing undue burden on industry. The public one ultimately, even if you're a full free market here, you'll probably admit some or other of it is borne by the consumer. I think we should have a precedent fiction in our reports, the two of you, the Sami, in our reports. We have to worry about this. So I mean, position one criteria, not the subject, is also the cost of inflation. Good, fine. We done with that, David?
Yeah. Yeah, I would nevertheless be interested in Basel's final report on what they think or what they estimate the cost of implementation will be and any recommendations they have as to how the bill can be amended or how transitional arrangements can be structured to mitigate cost of implementation.
We can do that, but remember, we must be very clear to Basel and anybody else that you can have a say, but ultimately it's the national interest as defined by a majority party in a democracy. So I don't want you to spend hours and hours. David doesn't have the weight he like thinks he does. He'd like to raise it, but unless you get majority support, which doesn't seem very likely, I need to do my job. So you will think about how much you're only spending hours and hours doing this report, right? And then you get very little out of it. And then what you do is the consumer will pay the cost of it, right? Or you know, that report that you're doing, who's going to pay for that report, right? You know, so basically, fine, but let us understand, not co-governing, not co-legislating. The banks and the economy can set up your financial sector independent party, than for election. You do better than the CA, by the way. So, you know, there's that you can think about. So, fine, you can have that. I think it's fair to give them a say, but the way the discussion is going, there are other parameters that are more alerting. Don't let customers and say, you know, spend hours now. They're waiting for the GA to come to power, which is waiting for governments, right? It's never going to happen, right? So, you know, your grandchildren can assume that issue with their grandchildren. Right, fine. Have you said what's the next issue? What's the next one? Yeah, it's going to change. Good. See the report, right? Everybody?
The next one is something that relates to the earlier discussion we had on the
other. Can we move on, please? Let's cover it.
11, you mean this color or 11?
Very good.
Point 12, relates to the issue of financial inclusion, Chair, and I think there are a number of responses to this. I think the simplest example is, for instance, the reduced
extent to which this bill encourages financial inclusion or not. Can you explain simply? It encourages financial inclusion, 1, 2, 3, 4. Reason why?
Maybe
it's
a
few or
not.
Yes, it's very much. Thank you. Our view is that the bill is an enabler of financial inclusion in the sense that it brings down the burden that was there before, that would have discouraged the users of financial protection services from assessing them because they had to comply with stringent requirements of obtaining addresses and letters from the chief and the counselor and all those kind of things, which are many people and discouraged, and some of them then probably they felt the need to put their money under the bed, therefore creating also another unreliable cash market that is not part of the formal system. So what we are doing in the field is then to say let's relax some of the provisions that then make easier for financial institutions to assist low income earners or anybody that wants to address certain problems. It also makes it easier for financial institutions to develop new products that are easily accessible and usable by those who are currently not covered by the former financial system. There are many risks that come with people not having access to the formal and regulated system. And so by then creating, in particular, the risk-based approach, that then helps to make sure that, that most people see the benefit of using formal financial institutions instead of relying on informal and cash-based system. So that in our view, Chair, is where this bill comes in. That's an enabler of financial inclusion. You would also see when the financial sector regulation bill comes before you again tomorrow that one of also the objects today is financial inclusion as well, as finding a way of promoting financial inclusion. By not necessarily prescribing any product or any service, but by just saying that we reduce the burden that has been there, that most people would have had to comply with and as a result would have been discouraged from then accessing the formal financial services.
Chair, if I could try and give arguably a real life example. So if you had someone coming from the informal settlement and he wished or she wished to open an account or to enter into a transaction with a financial institution but would not necessarily have acceptable proof in terms of residence, which tends to be the case with informal settlement dwellers. Under the current system, he or she would arguably find it very hard be able to open an account or transact with a financial institution unless he or she is able to provide acceptable proof. With a risk-based approach, that person should stand a better chance of being able to enter into such a transaction with a financial institution because the institution would then have its own rules in terms of what would be an ideal form of identification and verification for a person coming from an informal settlement vis-a-vis someone who might be coming from a township or a suburb. So in a way, a risk-based approach does say to you, someone like that, who is hopefully is not a prominent influential person, come from an informal settlement, does not unfortunately have a proof of resident, you can still onboard them subject to their own internal rules, which hopefully in such a case will indicate that that person is not high risk and therefore doesn't pose any major risk to your institution. Where currently under the hard rules system, you might find it very difficult coming from that kind of situation to be able to translate.
All right, I would have to add on where this goes in respect to financial inclusion. Okay, so basically what you're saying is, if I'm correct, this bill encourages financial inclusion because it allows people to open bank accounts who live outside of home residences in established communities, residential communities, I mean, when they use equipment. That's the only thing which encourages financial inclusion. Right? So which is the other sentence in which it does? people that you know, Scottish professor, you know, have this financial institution. I thought it was more than just the registration of the residential about, you know, that. Is there any other question we should have?
I think in general, of course, institutions decide for themselves what it is that they need to know their customer. Also allows institutions, for instance, when they deal with small business, to focus on the information about the small business and the business owner to identify them rather than irrelevant information such as where the business stays or what sort of information
they need. It's a small business. So you have financial institution one, individual couldn't do a bank account before came out. So two, small businesses.
The required information that the institution will have to obtain about the customer and verify about the customer, it also has a knock-on effect about information they have to store and keep records and stuff, so those of course will also be affected by how the upfront identification is done. So it can also bring down the cost of lower end products, entry level products for people to get access.
They can charge less for products because the administrative requirements are less onerous. So the three ways in which,
And that's a good point, because you see it when we bring the insurance bill, how we try to provide for low income customers in the form of micro insurance.
All right, very good, very good.
Chair, I think also in terms of the regulations and requirements to meet the existing regulations, what is an acceptable piece of identity, what is an acceptable document to verify address, etc. Those are being described at the moment. In the new regime, it's to an institution to decide what is within their appetite and what is within their acceptability to meet a specific requirement. So proof of address may come from a host of alternative sources to what is described at the moment, which opens up a huge gateway of opportunity of alternatives and even in terms of proof of identity, where the current act says you have to have a green barcode and ID should be a face-to-face engagement, otherwise you should be another add-on verification test to ensure that you find the most onboarding that you know who you're dealing with. With the reference approach, proof of ID can come through a host of other channels like electronic verification and the Department of Home Affairs, etc. So again, I think it opens up a window of opportunity in terms of financial inclusion. People are then have difficulty accessing physical branch of a bank, physical premises of an insurance company to get a funeral policy, etc. The channel and the ability to engage via alternative means of verification also encourages something of financial inclusion.
Yes,
Chairman, I should just also put that down that it does make life easier in the health regions, which at the moment has been a problem. We have to go through exemption and all those kind of things.
Yes, of course. Also, I want to ask you, it's not going to open up the floodgates also to, let's say, criminal activity. In other words, you know these people that do all these terrible things. They will use this loophole to do what they do. What you're doing here is a progressive provision can be abused and so on. I don't know, is that an issue or is not an issue? I don't know. I really don't know.
To build on what you're saying, is that all these alternatives may well be possibilities. But what is the probability of the institution taking the kind of risk the chair is now stating may be the case? So in other words, yes, the alternatives are there, and as an accountable institution, I must now assess the risk, and I say, I'm just not prepared to take this risk. I'm going to stick with the real McCoy ID book face-to-face, and because the risk is too high of you guys or whoever the supervising authority is coming in on and saying, you assessed the risk incorrectly, and we have advanced on those penalties.
I don't know whether it's relevant, but what about illegal residents who are here? We're not legitimate in South Africa. Not a legitimate model in the case maybe. Okay, I'm not questioning bad. What happens? Like, where do they bank their money? Can they get benefits. See, my issue here is, if a person is here from outside this country, you shouldn't be here. That's an issue for the Home Affairs and the Protection Police Services, and I don't know what it's like to deal with. But that person, in the meanwhile, is staying here. That person has a right to a financial institution. What happens now? I mean, do these people who are illegally here, what do they do? What happens to them? By the way, I'm not saying now, I'm not saying now that all these people that are here easily should be allowed to stay. I may have a view of the person, but it's not a view of the government or the parliament or the MP. I'm not saying that. I'm saying effectively what these people are, as a human being, they wouldn't come here, unless they're close, of course, they wouldn't come here if they had a choice to stay in the country. They come here because, economic means or political crisis. So, what happens now then?
This is a very difficult policy to write. Our approach from the FIC's point of view is that the FIC Act is not meant to regulate migration and shouldn't be used for that objective. If an institution can identify a customer by whatever means, then by all means they should go ahead and do business with the customer. The person's status in the country shouldn't play a factor whether the institution is allowed to do business, whether they decide to do business with that person or not, may be a risk decision that because the person is here tomorrow, the institution sits with the loan that they extended or whatever the payment be. So there are commercial factors that institutions would take into account. That said, however, there is provision in the immigration legislation that an institution, a financial institution, when they do business with a person who they suspect is illegally in the country or undocumented in the country, they must report that to the Department of Home Affairs. So that the Department of Home Affairs is aware of people that are in the country without the proper legal residence permits, etc., or asylum seekers, organization, etc. That is not a prohibition against the account or business being done, but it has a chilling effect on the person's willingness to do business with banks. They know they can be reported to the Home Affairs. So that policy issue, the discussion that is still being pursued between the financial inclusion versus the regulation state. But from a financial intelligence perspective, there's no prohibition against doing business with undocumented or even legal residents in the country as long as they can be identified properly. And we've actually tried to formulate the dispensation where institutions would rely on asylum seeker permits, etc., as a means of identification so that they can proceed to do business with people who are in the country but are not formally residents of the country. And that dispensation can well continue under the research approach without any sort of formal structure being provided. Because one of the means that Abigail said that the institution could use for the means of identification would be an official piece of paper from government that says that this is who this person tends to be, such as an asylum seeker document. So it does provide for that sort of scenario.
Okay.
One additional point I want to make, pick up on the risk issue and the cost of compliance. One of the things that we are very concerned about in the implementation of the legislation around costs is where institutions decide, not because of any obligation, but where they decide that doing a particular type of business is not profitable. So it's not the profitability of the institution that they are able to do business and make profits and deliver dividends to the shareholders. But because they have to comply with a particular way of doing business in a particular area, they might decide it's not profitable and therefore exit that business. And that in the international jargon is now called de-risking, and that's a serious concern for regulators. So for instance, migrants might be a vulnerable category of custom because it's too costly for institutions to business, not because there's any legal requirements that prevent it. And therefore they have to decide not to do that business. And that creates a different cost implication. Yes.
So you be vulnerable and enjoy the
I think that has something to do with the point I didn't break out of the original. And currently, the financial aid task force is actually correctly this issue because it's a global problem. There are a number of countries. And I remember one of the countries, I think Kenya also, had a situation like that where some remittance operating companies shut down accounts of particular clients and so forth. So, we are aware that that risk may arise even in our jurisdiction, where financial institutions just regard certain business as too risky and too costly to do a risk assessment.
think we will continue to also watch the guidance that will come also from the international assessing body that will deal with the issue of the risking as well.
Just a point of touch on the issue of probably illegal international ships in the country, but not only that, even South Africans who are doing business but they are not banking. Does this mean that FIC can't do anything, even if they are aware that such activities are happening, people like business and money is coming in and they are just putting some way but not banking? Does that mean that there's nothing that you can do and only the country can do something? Just to clarify on what role has the country can make play.
That's an interesting question. We haven't discussed, which is outside of the institution. People have money, right? And they could be dealing with terrorism, or they could be money laundering and so on, right? What is because of presumably a member of the public notifies you, says, hey, there's so and so here. Has got a bank account and stuff. What happens?
If I see receipt information that points towards illegal activity, it's an obligation of the FID in terms of our mandate under the Act to make that information available to the property investigating authority, whether it's the police service, revenue service, intelligence service, where we believe the state has to act on that information. And the whole paradigm, the structure of how the FIC Act works and FIC is created is for the FIC to discharge information to people who can act on that information. FIC doesn't have powers in and of itself to do investigations. We have to put that information in the health plan. If we hold on to the information, we defeat the objectives of the legislation. The fact is that the FIC is only, our ability to get information is severely reduced if the financial activity happens outside of the regulated financial sector. So if somebody doesn't bank to banks and doesn't interact to financial institutions, we have much less probability of getting the information about this person's activities. So therefore we want to encourage legislation that allows people to get access to the formal sector.
Okay.
Fine.
Right.
The
next one is very forward. Right? Casino just covered that, right? So that's ticked off that 13. 14 bankers. What are we supposed to do with this? I mean, they just came here and gave an idea. So here's your cost being reduced if they had any. I see there's a lot of representatives nodding heads, but look, I don't know. The responsibility of this parliament is to evaluate people's ICT software and all that. I mean, this is really something we've discussed already. That really is not germane to us. Good, you have to know what they said. 15?
This is the issue we discussed earlier.
Yeah, it's covered. 16? This is covered.
Yes.
17?
This is a comment on how institutions should manage risk within the institution. The bulk of obligations on the institution is around the identification or due diligence, not just identification, but what they know about the customer. And that's where the main application of risk approach will be focused. But it's also about the institution being able to identify when something suspicious is going on. So that is one of the aspects that has to be covered in this management program which we provide. I think the point is, I don't think there's anything we need to amend in the legislation.
So he thinks that we're going to change something. I mean, they probably we agree with this. Anybody disagree? No. All right, so fine, we agree with this. 18?
Just there were a few comments on the offence provisions. The one is that for the word offence, we keep fine. We don't need that necessarily because the offence provisions that tell us what elements of an offence is or are in the sections of the FID Act. I think there were other comments also on the offence provisions is about the fact that some criminal
thinking there.
Any comments on this one? I think it's fine. Good. Let's go. Next one, please. 18? No, 19, right?
Chair, there's a recommendation that one of the officials in the FRC that deals with the wide supervision that should be made up if the FRC allows all other supervisors to account. Now, that sort of amounts to making the FRC an uber supervisor or super regulator above other regulators. That's not the intention. That's contrary to the current policy in the financial sector to sort of elevate one regulator above others. I think there are sufficient means for coordination already in the legislation.
Yeah, I mean, that's section 45, right? Just look at page 29, it's amended section 60 of the Act. Look, I don't think there's much credence to be given to this. Well, why do they say it exactly came to the court? What
if they... Yeah, but I'm speaking of information, but I recall correctly, there's a feeling that some supervisors are more enthusiastic about their responsibility to supervise than others. The FRC should have somehow maintained an accountability role over the supervisors.
Is there anything here for a second? What do you think about the chair? Nothing more than what? I don't think we can make it this time. Right, so let's move on. Although we've done a lot of corruption work over, but I mean, really, it's not something we can do much about. Yeah. 20?
Chair, I call the request on 20 is about the means available to institutions to carry out identification, especially I think it's related to identification of beneficial owners. Our response is that we, while having tools and databases available to provide information about identification, that's not the only port of call. And institutions still carry their responsibility to identify their customers. There's also information each customer that they're dealing with. Obviously, having database information, etc., is also useful, but that's not the only source that institutions want that. And we can't take away the responsibility from institutions to meet their obligations to do the due diligence required.
Any comments here?
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to Mr. Tamani.
Listen,
yeah, no specific provision. So we take